Welcome to The Wonder, exploring perspectives, rituals, and observances of modern, naturalistic, earth-revering, pagan religious paths. Here are your hosts, Yucca and Mark.
Welcome back to The Wonder, science-based paganism. I'm one of your hosts, Mark.
And I'm Yucca.
And today we're going to talk about the future. We're going to talk about kind of where the world is now in our view and what our highest vision is for the future of humanity. Yep. So buckle up. It's going to be an interesting ride. We're glad to have you along with us.
And before we jump in, just a reminder to everyone, if you have any questions you would like us to address on this podcast, please email us. And Mark, what is that email?
It's the podcast. Oh, I'm sorry. That's wrong. It's the Wonder Podcast Qs at gmail.com. So the Wonder Podcast QS, all one word, at gmail.com.
Great. So, yeah, we're going to dive into our personal visions, right? I suspect that we haven't talked about this. Mark, you and I have not talked about our personal visions for the future. I'd be interested in seeing where we overlap. I suspect there'll be a lot of overlap, but I'm interested to see the differences as well.
So, yeah, me too. I mean, in our various conversations, it seems like we've had a lot of overlap in our kind of values and our general vision for how we practice paganism and what we're interested in that manner. But we haven't really talked about our vision for the future. So I'm excited to find out what you're thinking is about all that.
Yeah, likewise.
So where should we start?
Well, why don't we start with the challenges that we see in the world right now. Some of those things that we see that do need changing, at least from our perspective.
Sure. Great. Let's do that. Would you like to start or would you like me to start?
I'd be happy to start. Yeah.
Great.
So I think the core of many of the issues which we are facing, I believe, comes down to our relationship with the rest of life and with the rest of the biosphere. And the problem is that we see ourselves as separate from it, that we are not part of it. And we have this strange mix of both we're both anthropocentric at the same time as being very misanthropic. We both are focused on ourselves, and yet we also hate ourselves and do not want ourselves and see ourselves as not possible contributors to solutions, that we are somehow a cancer and anything we do is going to be harmful. And so the best that we could possibly do is do as little harm as possible, instead of seeing ourselves as powerful agents to influence the rest of the biosphere and perhaps help it in some way. And I think that that is the root of many of the challenges, whether that's our climate change or social justice, all of those things comes down to our relationship with ourselves and the rest of the world.
I really agree with that. The idea of becoming reconnected with the earth, of what they call resacralizing our relationship with the earth, is central to my practice and my ideas within atheopaganism, which is what I practice. The challenge, I believe, is to some degree keyed to a sense of overwhelm, because there are so many problems now that I think people just throw their hands up and say, there's nothing we can do. And unfortunately, population plays into this too, because I think with more and more and more people in the world, people are valuing one another less and less and less. And that is a danger.
Yeah.
The good news is that I think that there are also countervailing cultural movements that oppose that, that are about exalting the individual and celebrating their uniqueness and their difference and their value.
It gives me hope that there are movements like that, because often when we hear people talk about population, that ties into that idea I was telling you that I was just mentioning about seeing humans as cancer, as bad, and like you were saying, not valuing the individual, where I think that how we view it is very much a choice, and viewing individuals as beautiful in and of themselves, but also that the more people there are, the more opportunity there is for coming up with solutions. That how we frame that is very, can really change the outcome of the challenges that we are facing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How do we understand the problem? What is the problem that we're fixing?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Anything else?
So much. I think we could start talking about the specific issues that we're facing, that I think is addresses the root of many of them.
Okay.
Are there particular issues which are ones that you feel passionate about?
Well, I completely agree with your understanding of the disconnect between humanity and the rest of the biosphere, and how that cultural framing is so harmful, and it is spread around the world because it gives people goodies. It gives them some things that are very beneficial to them, like sanitation and healthcare and things like that. But also, under capitalism, we are taught that there is a giant hole inside us that must be filled. And advertising constantly bombards us with our need to fulfill some lack in ourselves or our lives or our status with a product or a service.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is as pernicious a problem as and it's connected to the lack of sacralizing of the natural world, because we are comfortable with grinding the world into widgets so that we can fill the widget sized hole inside ourselves. It's
that is never actually filled.
That is never actually filled, because the next advertisement comes along and tells you that you're now missing something else that some other widget will fill.
Mm-hmm. By the way, be embarrassed because there are bags under your eyes.
Yes.
Yeah. You should be ashamed about that.
Yes. And you need to buy this product in order to try to make that go away, which it won't, except to the degree that you think that it does, because the brain works that way. Mm-hmm. If you apply some kind of stuff and your brain will think, oh, the stuff must have helped. So I am very concerned about industrial capitalism and how it just seems hell-bent on grinding the entire world into money.
Mm-hmm.
I am not much of a consumer at all. I buy my clothing used. I buy my technology used. Not universally, but the laptop that I'm on right now, I bought used. And even when it comes to ritual gear and all that kind of stuff, I don't do any of that stuff either. I mean, I have all the stuff that I need to do effective rituals in my own experience. And most of that stuff is stuff I either made or found in mm-hmm. nature. So the obsession with consumption is something that, even though I understand it because I was raised in this culture, and so I can feel myself pulled by the desire for the latest phone or a better car or whatever that is, it leaves me cold. Mm-hmm. Because I know how empty it is, and I know what the cost to the world is. And my hope is that more and more people, and my belief is that subsequent generations to mine are starting to figure this out because they're broke, because the way the economy has been tooled for the last 40 years has been designed to leave them with nothing but debt. And so they're coming to understand that the value that they can get out of life is not encoded in products. Mm-hmm. It's in experiences, often with other people. And so I'm hopeful that kind of mentality is starting to gain some traction. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's the consumption, the endless consumption that is such a problem. And it would take a complete retooling of our culture, not just our economic system, but our culture, in order to change that.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting question in terms of where does that start? I mean, I think they feed into each other. Mm-hmm. But the economic system is going to follow the culture, and the culture following the economic system.
Exactly.
And something you said made me chuckle a little bit about, you're saying how with the younger generations that we are so broke that we can't engage in some of those activities.
Which I am too, I should say.
Yeah. Which I think it's certainly not just people from one generation, but I have to chuckle about the memes that go around about what old industry that millennials have killed. You know, we've killed golfing, or we've killed, you know, certain jewelry or things like that. It was like, well, you can't buy it.
You can't buy it. And you look at it for what it is, and it's like, no, I don't need that. Not for the ridiculously inflated prices that people pay for it. I don't need that.
And then some of them, it's like, well, we don't want what you're offering. Is it, did we kill it, or did you just not offer something of value?
I saw an article maybe 6 months, a year ago, something like that, that millennials were killing Applebee's.
Yes. Yeah, we're going in with knives and stabbing it. No, we just... do the basic math, and can you afford to eat out?
Yes. Expensive, crappy food is not high on the priority list of people who are under extremely tight budgets. It's just not.
Yeah. And when are we going to go between our second and third jobs?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, people are making even more profound decisions based on this. They're not having children. Many of them are just not having children because they can't afford to. And what that means is that many of the children of younger generations than mine are either unplanned, mm-hmm. And perhaps unwanted, which is its own set of tragedies and social costs.
For everyone.
Or their parents are struggling like mad in order to sustain them. And that's stressful and hard for them as they're growing up as well.
Yeah. And I think another reason that not as many people are having children is a strong sense that I think much of the generation has that we're not adults yet. Because we have not been able to achieve the things that our culture has as signals for adulthood.
Like buying a house or...
Or let alone a car, yes. You know, a new car, or, you know, house, uh-huh. a car, having a profession, not just a job, but having a career.
Right.
Those things which have served as rites of passage for us.
And I was just going to talk about rites of passage. I mean, that the real problem there is that we don't have them for people into adulthood. We'll do a show or more shows on rites of passage at some time, and talk more about that. But that is definitely a glaring deficiency in our current culture, is that people spend often their 20s and their 30s asking themselves, am I grown up yet?
Yeah.
And in some cases, they do really tragic things as a result.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the few things that were even close to being rites of passage, like the buying a house or things like that, are just beyond reach.
Yes. Yes.
And so I think one of the reasons I think that people aren't having children is that I'm not even an adult myself.
Right.
And I can certainly, so I'm 30 and I do have children and I do have, you know, I am married, which is, I guess, becoming more and more unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly have struggled with a lot of those feelings, and many of the people in my age group have struggled with that as well, mm-hmm. that I've spoken to. So there's some big shifts going on. And I hope out of this that there's struggles. There's deep struggles that we're having, but I hope from this weekend move in some directions that I think we can, I hope that we get some good out of this, right?
I hope so too.
Yeah.
Because there are profound changes that are happening, among other things, because the generations after the baby boom are so much smaller, just the sheer availability of workforce
mm-hmm.
to feed the engine of capitalism is reducing. And the combination of extremely low wages and a very small workforce is not sustainable. People will end up having to pay higher wages in order to get employees.
Yeah.
So it's going to be interesting to see how that all works out. I mean, we'll talk about vision for the future in a second, and I'm kind of rooting for the end of capitalism. So I don't want to see it recalibrate and fix itself. But that's certainly going to be a factor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be a profound factor in our economy when it comes to healthcare, because you'll have all of these elderly baby boomers who need healthcare and caretaking and all that kind of stuff, and just not so many Generation X, Millennials, Generation Y folks to take care of them or to pay into a tax system to take care of them. It's mm-hmm. it's a knotty problem.
Yeah. Yeah, that's just the start.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So we have established that there are definitely problems.
And we could keep going, but it's starting to feel heavy too.
Yes. But why don't we turn the page and talk about where we hope things are going and what we're working towards helping things to move towards.
Great.
In my writing on atheopaganism.org, and not so much in the book, maybe in a subsequent book, I don't know. But when I talk about the future, I really am thinking about the work that I'm doing and that community is doing as creating new models for culture.
Mm-hmm.
Because I believe that there is a lot of catastrophe that's coming that's unavoidable at this point. Climate change is on us. It's not just a threat. It's happening.
Yeah.
It's here. And it's going to continue to be here even if we stop all carbon emissions tomorrow. And we're not going to do that.
Yeah.
So climate change is a fact of life for the coming centuries. And it's going to have profound effects on agriculture, on industry, on communities, on populations of people who live near the ocean. It's going to make a lot of difference. And I don't believe that the global system of industrial capitalism will be able to continue to function under the chaotic conditions that climate change is bringing.
Yeah.
Now, there are a bunch of different scenarios for how that could play out. I mean, there's the Mad Max scenario, where it's just sort of post-apocalyptic wasteland and everybody is, you know, killing one another for resources and survival. And maybe that'll happen in some places. But I believe people are going to try to hold on to human decency and that altruistic, cooperative approach that we talked about in our last episode, that is more helpful for long-term survival than being competitive.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of what I'm working to do in promoting, not so much promoting, it's just sort of putting out into the world the values and practices of atheopaganism, is seeking to create a new model for culture that's about reverence for the biosphere and connectedness with the natural world and connectedness with one another and valuing what's really important,
mm-hmm.
rather than the widgets.
Yeah.
So my hope is that these ideas will persist even as things go to hell for a while. That's in a nutshell, that's kind of my vision, my hope for the future. And then we can renormalize, probably in smaller communities, mm-hmm. that are more self-sustaining, and that therefore have a much more personal relationship with the land where they live. And then we can start to sort out, you know, what from the old way was a value and we should pursue, and what is stuff that wasn't a value and we don't need to pursue.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense?
It does, yeah.
How about you? How about your vision for the future?
Well, there's so many places to start from. But I come at it from a very practical place. And I think that the way that the biggest way in which we relate to the rest of biosphere is agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that we do is related to agriculture. And right now the system is an industrial system that is really mining. It does not take into consideration how these natural processes actually work. And it's just running on borrowed time here. So we're harming our soils and we are destroying our soils and destroying our resources. And so I'm most interested in seeing how we can shift back to restoring those soils, not just stopping destroying them, but healing them and building back thick, healthy soils. And in that process, I think that the more people within the population have to get back involved with the basic production. Because mm-hmm. right now, most of our population in the whole world is actually in cities. And there's a deep disconnect of how these processes work. And I think we see this in movements, although very well-intended, but movements like veganism and things like that, that are coming from these urban environments that just really don't have a great understanding of how the whole system works. So mm-hmm. I think we need people back in nature, being part of nature and recognizing that everything that we are doing is in fact part of nature, mm-hmm. and that it's going to work out a lot better for us if we work with those processes and look at what these organisms, whether that's a crop or an animal or whatever it is, how did they evolve to behave and how can we match that to achieve whatever the goal is that we want. And in this case, I think that would be improving the soil and giving everybody access to their means of survival. Because that's how we control people, is make it so that they can't survive without us, right? So
you
can control their water, their food, and without it even having to be a sinister thing, not suggesting that it's a group of people going, ha ha ha, let's take over and control all these people, but the way that our capitalist system is set up, it really encourages that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we need to move towards some decentralization with our food production, bringing it back to something that matches the local environments of where we are. Because if it's made thousands of miles away, if it's made outside of your site, even if you care, it's hard to have any influence in how it's done.
Right.
And with as little, and it's hard to become educated on all of these subjects too. You know, if I'm buying food that was all grown in Australia or South America, I have to trust some report that I read, somebody with a strong, with a really strong food agenda about whether it was healthy or not healthy for the mm-hmm. local ecosystem. So bringing that back closer to us, I think is a huge first step. And I'm not suggesting that everybody go out and become rural farmers. I think that there's wonderful things about cities, but they're complete food deserts. So
many of them are. Yeah. Many of them are. And I mean, there are things that could be done in cities that would enhance that a lot, like getting rid of supermarkets.
Yeah.
Having people buy at farmers markets rather than supermarkets, or at least having supermarkets only be dry goods mm-hmm. rather than produce.
Yeah.
Because then, you know, and this is how it used to be, that all the vegetables would get loaded up in carts or wagons or whatever it was, come into the city on market day, and you would have a relationship with the farmer mm-hmm. who sold you your lettuce and your turnips and whatever it was.
Yeah.
And at that point, you begin to become aware of the seasonality of produce.
Mm-hmm.
Which
has a richness in itself.
It does. Yeah. It does. You start to understand that, I mean, even just the nature of the produce that you get in a farmer's market, it tends to have a little more dirt on it. You start to understand this came out of the ground. Mm-hmm. And this person in front of me grew it so that it could be sold to me here.
Yeah.
I think that makes a tremendous difference rather than the supermarket experience of, you know, fluorescent lighting and, you know, this all very antiseptic setup. It's just not, it's not the same. It's not conducive to feeling any kind of a connection to the source of your food.
Yeah. It's just a product.
Yes.
And you don't have, you know, it you don't have any feeling of responsibility around it and have mm-hmm. no, and in terms of health, you really don't know what you're putting in your body.
Right.
And how that affects us.
Right.
Yeah.
To be honest, I worry far less about human health when it comes to this stuff than I do about ecological health. You know, the reason that I support organic farming, for example, even though there are many problems with organic farming, including mm-hmm. some of the so-called natural pesticides that they're allowed to use.
Yeah, that's a
kind of an issue. But at the very least, organic farming has a tendency to be soil building and not to be as toxic for the surrounding ecosystem as those that use, you know, industrial petrochemical fertilizers and pesticides.
Yeah. Now, I am concerned on the human health component for multiple reasons. One, I love humans, right? I mm-hmm. think that we are wonderful. But I also think that that's a powerful motivator for if you can't get the folks to necessarily care about it just for the sake of caring about the rest of the environment, they might care about it because it influences their own body and their own sure. loved ones, right? So sure. I think that being aware of both of those levels is important. Mm-hmm. And as someone who does have children, you know, I think a lot about the future of humanity.
Uh-huh.
And
With children, you're talking about concentrating those chemical additives in much smaller bodies.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a legitimate concern, I think, is just, for one thing, children eat a lot.
They do, yeah.
Because they're growing, they're building their bodies. So there's a lot of throughput, but their bodies are small. So you can bioaccumulate an awful lot of stuff really quickly.
Mm-hmm. And interestingly, there's also the problem of we're feeding them all this food, but how much nutrients are they actually getting from it now compared to what it was when you were growing up or what sure. it was when our parents or grandparents, and there's a lot of very concerning data regarding the drop of nutrition in industrial produced foods.
Yes, I've seen that. And it is kind of amazing. I mean, the diet that I ate when I was a kid back in the Pleistocene when Cro-Magnons roamed the earth, was a terrible one. It was the sort of convenience diet that emerged from the 1950s with a lot of frozen stuff and sort of prepackaged processed food. So I don't know that I would be a very good example. But
however, still far better than what it is now, even if you weren't
eating. That's possible.
Yeah,
that's very possible. And particularly some of the dietary fads that have come along, you know, like veganism, for example, which, you know, really doesn't pencil out for much of what's claimed for it, are, once again, I think, you know, legitimate attempts to do something that's good, and they're just not, they're not entirely big picture things. They remind me of, we were talking last time about pagan ethics, mm-hmm. and we talked about these very, very broad brush sort of absolutist statements that circulate in the pagan community. And I think some of these dietary trends are similarly sort of attempts to make something happen through one very simple action.
Yeah, it would be wonderful if that was the solution, right?
Sure.
And, you know, it's where people are scared and they really honestly want to help. And so I think, like you're yes. saying, it comes from a good place in the heart. I think that corporate interests take huge advantage of that and may
Absolutely.
Actually be causing much more harm than good from it. But it's a desire to help, which I think is a great start. But there needs to, I think there needs to be more education around it. But
so yeah. we kind of got off track. You were talking about your vision for the future.
Yeah. So, you know, I guess I did start to talk a lot about the problems again, but I think that there's a wonderful opportunity for a reconnection. And I think that when people get their hands in soil, mm-hmm. You know, it makes a huge difference on the emotion. And there's all kinds of reasons we can talk about that, whether mm-hmm. it's your, you know, gut biota or vitamin D or just that sense of being able to, that gratitude, that connection. But all of those things can make a huge difference for people. And I think that people are kind of getting forced in that direction because of some of the economic things we were just talking about.
I agree.
And from that, though, there's a wonderful potential for us to start to redevelop redevelop local cultures that aren't just part of this huge amorphous Pan-American, you know, Pan-Western thing. Not that there isn't a value in there as well, but that I think it's devoid of a lot of the more rich experiences that we can have as humans.
Yes.
And that we just have this potential to reconnect, to connect with that, the farmer bringing the vegetables in, or the neighbors who you're trading with. And I'm excited to see a blend of a return to some of these skills that we have lost over the last few generations, mm-hmm. added in with some of the new things, some of the new technology and ways of communicating that we have now. Mm-hmm. You know, how is that going to blend with the global communication that we have that has just swept across the world in just the last few years, that it's so right. part of everyone's life?
Right.
So, you know, I'm excited for that synthesis and seeing what's going to happen with that. And I'd love to see more earth reverence out of that, and and people being more, feeling more free to learn what they want to learn. And I mean, that's another education, and learning is another
whole other topic.
Yeah,
yeah, I have opinions on that as well.
Yeah. I'll just give the listeners a hint. My family, we are very interested in the unschooling or self-directed education movement. We're tying into that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's definitely related with our experience as pagans as well. So,
mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I think one thing that's happening now that is kind of reflective of where we're both talking about, you know, hoping for the future, is in intentional communities. I should say the nature of an intentional community has changed an awful lot since 1969.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not the old fashioned commune. There are intentional communities now that are practicing permaculture and collaborative, mostly consensus based kind of decision making, egalitarian decision making, and are really focusing the spiritual dimension of what they're doing on relationship with the earth. So I think that those are important pieces in terms of getting those models out there. And, and you know, those are probably the last bastions of what passes as normal as things start to kind of go crazy with climate change.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, big problems and big dreams.
Yep. So I suppose one thing that we, all of this is of course related, but bringing it back to the non-theist pagan, how do you see non-theist paganism fitting in to all of this?
Well,
how would you like to see it?
Yeah. Well, that relationship with the sacred earth,
mm-hmm.
is essential, I believe, in order for humans to live sustainably. And that word has been bandied around a lot, and right now it's kind of meaningless. It's not a metric that can actually be measured, but it's a vision.
Mm-hmm.
And for humans to actually live in a truly reciprocal relationship with the biosphere is going to take an ethic. It's going to take a heartfelt value around the importance of the biosphere. I believe that the way non-theist paganism can help foster that is that it's the spirituality of reality. It doesn't ask us to subscribe to stuff that almost certainly is not true. Mm-hmm. All it asks us to do is to look at the world as is demonstrably true. Maybe there's other stuff that's true, maybe there's not, but we can demonstrate that the universe is as physics and biology tell us it is. We've tested it, and the laws and the theories that we use to explain the nature of these things hold up. And to the degree they don't hold up, we're still testing. We're still figuring it out. And we have a process that is reliable for determining what is most likely to be true.
It's called science.
Yes, that's science. So these coming generations, which are abandoning the old religions willy-nilly. The number of people that self-define as no religion is skyrocketing in the United States and is already very, very high in Europe. Mm-hmm. But people still need spirituality. They still need a sense of connectedness and of purpose and of belonging in the world. And Ethiopaganism or other non-theist pagan paths are a means to having that experience and celebrating the passage of seasons and the transitions of nature and the wonders of nature in a way that's really fulfilling, but doesn't ask you to subscribe to stuff that is probably fiction. Mm-hmm. So in a science-informed world, which increasingly this is, recent backlash notwithstanding, I believe non-theist paganism is a way for us to marry religion and science and go forward in a manner that is both spiritually and intellectually fulfilling and grounded. So that's my take.
I think that's beautiful. I think that's actually, if you feel ready, a fantastic place to end the podcast.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Let's do that.
Yeah. Did we want to do a plug for the Indigenous Climate Action?
Let's do that. Yeah. I just sent them a check. The Ethiopaganism community actually has a Zazzle store on Zazzle.com called the Ethiopagan Store. Mm-hmm. And I just got notified that I have $100 in royalties from sale of various swag with the Ethiopagan symbol on it and stuff like that, t-shirts and mugs and that kind
of
stuff.
A lot of sales if you got 100 from it.
It is, because Zazzle doesn't give you very much.
$1.50, $2 per sale. Yeah,
so it's been a while accumulating, but now I have this $100. So I just sent it off to the Indigenous Climate Action Network, indigenousclimateaction.com. They are a Canadian Indigenous Peoples organization working on climate change issues, and particularly as they impact Indigenous communities, and also to see to it that Indigenous voices and perspectives are incorporated into Canada's national efforts around climate change. They're a great organization. And so once again, it's indigenousclimateaction.com. And I encourage people to go there, learn about them, and donate to them. So maybe we can close with a poem.
Yeah, sounds great.
All right, let's do that. All right, this is called an Ethiopagan prayer. Praise to the wide spinning world, unfolding each of all the destined tales compressed in the moment of your catastrophic birth, wide to the fluid expanse, blowing outward, kindling in stars and galaxies, in bright pools of Christmas-colored gas, cohering in marbles hot and cold, ringed round gray and red and gold and dun and blue, pure blue, the eye of a child spinning in a veil of air, warm island, home to us, kind beyond measure, the stones and trees, the round river flowing sky to deepest chasm, salt and sweet. Praise to time, enormous and precious, and we with so little seeing our world go as it will, ruining, cheering, the treasured fading, the precious arriving, fear and wonder always. Praise, O black expanse of mostly nothing, though you do not hear, you have no ear nor mind to hear. Praise, O inevitable, O mysterious. Praise and thanks be a wave expanding from this tiny temporary mouth, this tiny dot of world, a bubble going out forever, meeting everything as it goes, all the great and infinitesimal, gracious and terrible, all the works of blessed being. May it be so. May it be so. May our hearts sing to say it is so. See you next week, everyone.